All right, welcome to the next lecture in the Lauterbach Center's Friday lecture series. And welcome to those joining us online. And also thank you to Cambridge University Press for their sponsorship of the series. Today, I'm delighted to introduce Daniel Joyce, Associate Professor at the Faculty of Law and Justice, University of New South Wales, Sydney. He's also currently a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics and Political Science Law School in London. Daniel's research focuses on international law, media law, and human rights. Most recent monograph, Informed Publics, Media, and International Law, was published not that long ago in 2020. Daniel's no stranger to Cambridge. He's here as a PhD student. He was also a visiting research fellow here at the Lauterbach Center in 2018. So it's with great pleasure that we welcome him back to the center once more, this time speak to us about international law's entanglement communications infrastructure. Daniel.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tor. It's really wonderful to be here. Thank you, Sarabi, as well for the invitation and opportunity to come, and to Vanessa too for making everything so smooth. As Tor was saying, I think for me, the Lauterbach Center feels a bit like a sort of an academic home, in the sense that it's the place where I first really learned about international law by coming to many of these lectures. And I've had, you know, feel really lucky to have maintained that connection over the years. It's really a delight to return today. So this paper is part of, I guess, a project that I'm developing at the moment, which draws on, as Tor said, my monograph and sort of work I've been conducting for many years, focuses on the interrelationship between media law and international law. And then with Jesse Homan and a really great network of and community of other international law scholars, including Sarabi, we had this project called International Objects, which considered kind of questions around materiality and tried to look at the blurring of kind of subjects and objects in international law. And it's really quite a creative kind of project. And so I guess what I found myself returning to after the monograph is really some of the kind of overlapping themes from those two projects. So thinking about infrastructure for me has been a kind of interesting and kind of creative way to engage with questions of materiality, but also to think about how international law has this kind of communicative dimension, and also, I guess, to respond to some of the questions that many are concerned about within kind of media law or platform governance, about what to do about private actors and corporations and so on. So I guess that's the kind of the background for the paper that I'm presenting here today. It basically draws on an article that has recently come out on communications infrastructure, technological solutionism, and the international legal imagination. But I'm also, while at LSE, interested to further develop and trying to further develop more specific examination of the League of Nations period, for example, which I think is a really fertile time to think about these questions. And also interested in thinking about how kind of colonial historical settings might be quite different. So India, Australia, and obviously many other contexts. So there are other kind of future kind of strands, and I really welcome the chance to sort of think with you today about this project. So contemporary infrastructures encompass dynamic networks and assemblages that enable and control flows of goods, people, and information over space. The focus today in this paper is on communications infrastructure, but there are a range of further domains where infrastructure has captured the international legal imagination, including rivers, dams, the built environment, digital humanitarianism, governance of energy, electricity, railways, shipping containers, natural resources, borders, or time. Contemporary interest in the regulatory force of infrastructure also draws upon a material turn in the international legal imagination. And this paper really also responds to work that Sarabi, but also Benedict Kingsbury and the InfraReg group at NYU have done on thinking about the ordering kind of dimensions of infrastructure itself. The history of, I mean, the thing here too is that although there is this material dimension, as Benedict Kingsbury reflects, infrastructure now often involves the combination of the physical, informational, or the digital. So obviously, thinking in historical terms, thinking about the cables particularly and the earlier kind of transatlantic cable makes us think about the material in a particular way. Now, actually, I think communications infrastructure involves all three aspects. So I think it also makes it quite interesting. So it's digital, it's informational, and it's physical. The history of international legal engagement with the development of communications infrastructure reveals, as I argue, a recurring pattern of looking to technological infrastructure for solutions to global problems. And I'm concerned that this can act to empower private actors and contributes to an ongoing absence of meaningful international legal regulation of communication. The contemporary turn to infrastructure and its implications in terms of fostering the private power of big tech over global communications is in many ways, I am arguing here, a return. So part of what this paper is about is trying to say, well, look, yes, many people are worried about big tech and these private actors, but actually if you look back to the transatlantic cable and the emergence of communications infrastructure, those private actors were very present. And there's a really interesting global history, hi Vasuki. there's a really interesting kind of global history of communications that I draw on here that has begun to consider some of these questions. So connecting current debates with these earlier moments in international legal history, I think can help to highlight and counter continuing patterns of technological solutionism within the international legal imagination. And here I'm drawing on Yevgeny Morozov, who's written about technological solutionism, particularly in the context of the internet. He counsels against what he says is the automatic conferral of legitimacy upon a panoply of new, clean, and efficient technological solutions presented by big tech companies. He recognizes that solutionism is not a new mode of responding to problems, but critiques such an approach for putting the answer ahead of the question, foreclosing deeper investigation of the problems. Now, depoliticization and utopian thinking associated with technological solutionism are, of course, also characteristics that have resonance for the international legal imagination, particularly, I think, as it grapples with technology. This can also contribute to a conviction that we must look forward rather than backwards in managing and fixing the kind of unique revolutionary kind of moments. And obviously, scholars and I'm happy to say now judges like Hilary Charlesworth have written convincingly and very creatively about the ways in which the international legal imagination has been entangled with the mindset of perpetual crisis, which has sort of limited itself. And I'm kind of thinking here that the ways in which we've approached technology and infrastructure in international legal terms, even when they appear to be new and fresh and experimental, actually may be foreclosing other options and possibilities, and often foreclosing any form of actual governance or regulation. So turning to infrastructure may result in a failure of the international legal imagination insofar as I've said, in that it results in strengthening private forms of monopoly power and precludes alternative ways of governing technology. The emergence of international organization of communications infrastructure also, of course, helped to shape a managerial approach to international governance, but it sustained a role for private actors alongside states, which I see it's continuing to the present day. And here, I think, is where we can make those connections to contemporary debates about how to manage the power of these private actors and whether, I mean, often when I speak about international law in the media, I'm told fairly flatly, international law doesn't really have a place here, global governance doesn't have a place, it's all about multi-stakeholderism, as if this is some kind of innovative and new force, and in some ways it is. But it also actually, I think when you look back to the history, you can see that states and private actors were operating in tension, but also using each other for different purposes through that time. And as I said at the start, even though my focus here is on international law and its histories, I think one could also view these questions productively, and I hope to in the future, through a lens of more parochial imperial forms of political economy and their connections to infrastructure. So one example, powerful example here is the role which electrification played as an underlying infrastructure for both globalization and empire. So international organization itself arose in part to manage these practical problems of transport and communication. And the role of international law is presented often as one of being an underlying coordinating mechanism for international communication, and is often traced back in the sort of standard narratives to the rise of the telegraph and things like the transnational post service. So in World War I, efforts were made to generate the great network of treaties on such subjects as arbitration, copyright, patents, money, railways, posts, and telegraphs. And these developments in turn depended on communications technologies such as the telegraph and on forms of global transportation, which drove global trade and commerce at the time. Influential international legal accounts of this era point to the role played by international law and lawyers in managing these developing technological affordances to bridge space, time, and distance. A number of international organizations, of course, as you'll be aware, were formed to oversee this infrastructure for the coordination of common resources and for transnational economic activity. However, as we know, the economic benefits which accrued from advances in communications and other forms of globalizing technologies were not equally available. Standardization, interoperability, and public oversight of common infrastructure were key modes of advancing this vision for global order. And the kind of key organization here that I'm interested in is the International Telecommunications Union. So the ITU's history can be traced back to those earlier efforts to coordinate and control global telegraphic networks. And as we now know, those networks and their cables have in fact, and in turn, provided the material foundations for the emergence of the internet, generated by the conjoining of computing software and telecommunications hardware. So for media law, scholars talk about this in terms of convergence. We don't need to sort of think about the sort of the material and the content aspects being separated. So again, though, this vital global communications infrastructure is often privately owned, vulnerable to interference, and unequally distributed. Today, this is the UN specialized agency, that's the ITU, which is focused on information and communications technologies. And it's played a role within more recent efforts to develop a global information society and presently what's termed a global digital compact. But as many scholars have noted, it's struggled to maintain its relevance in light of regional developments, the rapid liberalization of the telecommunications sector since the 80s, and the convergence that I've talked about of infrastructure and content that's occurred with digitalization. So that's the kind of bigger picture. I'm just going to check the time and we're all good. The bigger picture, I guess, that I'm sort of trying to paint here. But I now want to kind of step back to think about the earlier kind of developments in relation to the telegraphy. So in the mid-19th century, a number of developments in the field of electricity allowed for signals to be sent along cables and subsequently also through the air. The role played by electrification in globalization and in connecting governance and innovation is fascinating, though often underemphasized in international legal accounts. As Toby Walsh notes, electricity invisibly permeates all aspects of our lives. Walsh, who's an AI scholar at my university in Australia, very popular person right now, as people are very focused on, and I guess the infrastructure of AI as a sort of next step in these questions, predicts that AI itself will one day play a similar function to electricity. One illustrative example of these developments was the breakthrough made by painter and inventor Samuel Morse with the single-wire telegraph and Morse code. Such advances in harnessing electricity for communications in turn developed into the broader field of telegraphy, with the first telegraphic cable connecting Britain and France laid in 1850 and a transatlantic cable established in 1858. Although that first cable was actually a failure over time. So it took a little while for them to kind of work through those tech issues. And I've been working on another sort of paper about, which is sort of an interesting digression in a way, about the cable, which then actually Tiffany, so working with my wife, Katie Dyer, who's a curator, and looking at the sections of that first cable, which were a failure, but were kind of cut up into little pieces and kind of, if you like, commodified, turned into kind of merchandising for particularly the American consumer market, who in a way kind of held on to these bits of cable as sort of, I guess, sort of kind of mementos of a sort of moment of kind of relevance and global significance. Apparently in the UK, there was less excitement about the failed cable. But I also think there are a number of different ways we can think about sort of subject formation too through these physical objects. So Stephen Humphreys has connected the history of these transoceanic cables with the French Revolution and notes that the first underwater telegraph cable was actually laid by the East India Company. The mix of public and private power, and I'm quoting in part from Stephen here, in state influence and support entwined with commercial interest. And I think this prefigures the geoeconomic rivalries attached to the digital economy today. Humphreys argues that the development of undersea cables was initially dominated by the great Victorian British state, but that the initiative would soon pass, with occasional subsidized support, to American enterprise. The very first Atlantic Telegraph Company set the tone, combining public and private, British and American capital. And again, I'm referring to Stephen's work there. Kate Crawford, an Australian AI scholar, in her very fascinating new work, trying to kind of help us navigate this area, reflects that like artificial intelligence, the telegraph was hailed as a unifying technology that would expand the capabilities of human beings, and notes that it became dominated by one of the first great industrial monopolies, Western Union. So there's this sort of connection, I guess, between kind of innovation, infrastructure, coordination, but also kind of private power and monopoly power. And that this in turn helped shape conditions for the emergence of monopoly capitalism more broadly. So in terms of the development of the ITU and some of the, I guess, treaty frameworks around, around it, European states met in Paris for an international telegraphic conference, resulting in the agreement of the International Telegraph Convention in 1865 and the establishment of the IT, well, at that time it was called the International Telegraph Union, which is the precursor to today's ITU. This treaty and the process through which it was established was viewed by the eminent American international lawyer Manley Hudson as, quote, a turning point in the move towards the use of treaties as multilateral frameworks with a quasi-legislative character to structure and order international cooperation. Subsequent conferences, of course, were held to revise and consolidate the regulations for a uniform system of telegraphy and to guarantee the effective functioning of the nascent system of global telecommunications. As I've said, ultimately, this infrastructure, this communications infrastructure, would lead to the internet and today's digital economy and platforms. But over the course of the 20th century, the ITU was involved in a range of different activities in, you know, with many of these different mediums. So radio, telephony, satellites, and space, and a host of other infrastructural and development activities. The ITU's work was often characterized as technical, which had benefits as well here in terms of encouraging state participation. And also, I think, reflected debates over the changing character of international law and the ambitions of those who sought to shape and define its future. And I do think there is a bit of a temptation here, I won't go into it too much, a temptation in a sense to view the infrastructural as somehow not being as political or as being more technical. I guess this plays out in some of the debates over whether international law should be approached as a technical form of governance as opposed to as a form of kind of morality. And in the paper, I look at some of the work of Hans Kelsen writing critically about, I guess, the League of Nations, which interestingly was really engaged with some questions around broadcasting, information, disinformation, you know, infrastructural questions at that time. And I won't read out the quote from him, but as scholars like Monica García Salmones Rivera have argued, who've looked, you know, much more closely into those debates, this project of positivism within international law, with which Kelsen and other figures were associated, is, she says, economic, in the sense that the new positive normativity is designed to be at the service of commercial exchanges and offers a means to resolve conflicts of interest between private and public entities. Again, some of these similar kind of dynamics, I think, that we see in current forms of international law and its entanglement with what on earth we should do. And I don't have the answers on that front either, with, you know, platform governance and so on. And so a simpler narrative told of the emergence of international organization as an inevitable response to technologies of globalization, I think, risks underplaying this economic significance of infrastructure and the roles that were historically assigned to corporations and private actors in the development of international law itself. And here I think Doreen Lustig's work has really powerfully illustrated more broadly that modern international law constitutes a framework within which businesses and governments allocate resources and responsibilities, a framework that began to operate as early as the late 19th century and continued throughout the 20th century. As Lustig argues, while private business corporations rarely appeared as a standalone issue in the international legal texts of the 20th century, international regulation was a key factor in their historical development. And here is where we can also connect with some of the global historians of communications like Simone Muller, who notes in her pioneering global history of telegraph networks that submarine telegraphy followed the logic of private enterprise and that states relied on neutral, so-called neutral cable companies to mediate between them, where otherwise state-centric notions of jurisdiction and territorial sovereignty would impede what she terms is the wiring of the world. You know, which in a way, I guess, is something that is this sort of fantasy for international lawyers as well, that they're sort of somehow kind of providing their own form of infrastructure, their own form of wiring for the world, although it seems like in the current day quite a disconnected and messy form of wiring. The emergence of telegraphy enabled capitalist exchange and supported the development of particular global capitalist systems, consolidating markets, obviously involving Europe and America, but also subsequently creating new markets, such as the Pan-American and Pacific markets. In the process, Muller and Heidi Tworek, another historian who's worked on this area and done a lot of really interesting work, reflect that the interaction between telegraphy and capitalism reinforced social orders that excluded most of the world's population based on concepts of race, gender, and class from participation in global communication. So when I was talking before about, you know, the merchandising of the first failed transatlantic cable, from what we can tell, it's actually cheaper to buy a bit of the cable than it was to actually use the cable for an American consumer at the time. But in my very preliminary kind of study of, for example, how telecommunications infrastructure was managed and evolved in the colonial Indian context, for example, it's quite a different kind of approach. There's much more of a kind of command control, military sort of bureaucracy usage of these telegraphs and much less selling them as a kind of an imaginary, I guess, to an emerging consumer class. So I also think we need to be careful about acknowledging the very different kinds of contexts and histories of these communications infrastructures. And in that way, as I've sort of indicated, it may be there that the kinds of debates that we're having about, you know, whether international law is truly international and the need to be more comparative may also be a very useful way to think. I mean, it might be more productive in certain contexts to do some kind of comparative examples. I'm quite interested in thinking about Australia which I think is also quite driven by a sort of state-centric public model, and then other contexts as well.
So they're the kinds of bigger questions that I'm trying to kind of engage with that draw into view, I think. So I think that communications infrastructure then, which seems quite obscure, and an area a bit like sort of my efforts to kind of bring media more broadly into the kind of international legal frame, often seems like a little bit sort of off to one side. I think that actually thinking infrastructurally about these questions can help us really to connect the themes both within kind of the history of kind of global communications and infrastructure, but also connect them more fully to some quite resonant kind of parallel themes within the development of kind of international legal history itself. And so that's what I feel is a sort of is exciting about this research. And there's a lot of other people doing this work as well. Now, I think we're in a sort of a moment where perhaps there is again more interest in cables, in you know, the ITU, and in these areas that have seemingly been, you know, been kind of set aside as more kind of technical, kind of you know, less, not really questions for lawyers, more questions for engineers. And so I you know, also want to acknowledge some really exciting work coming through, not only from people at InfraREG and from Benedict, who's really been an inspiration here, but also Nagar Mansour, if you're interested. She has done some fantastic work that, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing how that evolves. Chu Kong as well, and Roxanne Vatanparast are all kind of working on different elements of this. So I'm really hoping that this could be a bit of a kind of, you know, and obviously Sarabi's work here too has inspired many of us, and that this can be a kind of a bit of a new way into some of these kind of questions, which can, I think, offer us the opportunity to think about information as well and how it operates in international legal terms, but in a slightly different way than a kind of more content, free speech focused kind of view allows us to, which is, I guess, what I've tried to do in earlier work. Okay, so shall I go for another sort of 10 minutes?
We'll leave time for questions.
Yeah, great. So as I've said, it's tempting to view contemporary developments involving international law and infrastructure as presenting a novel challenge to this more traditional conception of international law as a system of rules, dispute, settlement, and organization. But I think if you look more closely at the history of communications technology and infrastructure's entanglement with international law, even at an earlier time, international organizations and the treaties underpinning their activity were imagined as functioning at least partly. So I think there's also some kind of interesting sort of, you can play with some of those kind of parallels a little bit there too. And this approach has over time, I think, resulted, sadly for me, I think, in the consolidation of private forms of infrastructural power without meaningful public forms of accountability. And I'm perhaps a little old school here. I know many people disagree with my approach here, and I know that the state and the public can also, you know, enact and contribute to many, and has to many of the kind of inequalities, problems, violence, and so on. But for me, the answer is not just handing it all over to big tech and pretending that there isn't a sort of sense of continuity in that. And I think when you look at, in some ways, the inability of international law to really govern many of these areas over time, the presence and power of these private actors is a big part of that story that, you know, we need to, I think about more. Okay, so when we recall earlier developments with regards to telecommunications, we are reminded of a field of international activity with a complex history illustrating public and private characteristics, soft and hard forms, and containing a co-constitutive conception of infrastructure's relationship to global ordering.
So David Runciman here in Cambridge points to the deeper connections between the state and corporations that we can also see in the earlier history of communications infrastructure and international law. Runciman reflects that no corporation, however rich or powerful, can exist without the support of the state. They're created in law and they operate through the web of rules and regulations that the state provides to manage them. And obviously Katharina Pistor's work is also really interesting and generative here too. I think we're not kind of like absolving law of its role here as well, or seeing it as a sort of, you know, a solution necessarily, but trying to be aware of kind of the critical, of a more critical way of kind of thinking about the dynamics. So a critical awareness of the connections between empire and law in fostering the power of corporations reveals an underlying pattern, which has tended, I think, to be obscured in contemporary debates over international law and technology, which tend to be presented in fairly shiny, new, presentist, sort of tech solutionist terms. The international legal imagination needs to better account for earlier practices of exploitation and their relocation in modern forms of information capitalism, with their reliance on privatized infrastructure for global publics. Considering contemporary debates over infrastructure alongside these earlier relevant moments in international legal history, and I've talked mainly today about the transatlantic cable in bigger picture terms, but I think we can look to interesting periods like the League of Nations period, also the Cold War confrontation and debates over a new world information communications order and rights to information. I know Wan Shu Kong, I've written a little bit about that myself, and she's doing some really interesting work in that area too, as have many critical communications scholars too, and debates around the right to communicate. Often that was about the digital divide and so on. And I think we can also kind of, through those periods, start to also think about maybe alternatives, alternative ways of imagining, alternative ways of thinking about, you know, this really significant public infrastructure and how we manage it. So my concern here is not to deny or avoid dealing with the kinds of contemporary developments that I think we have to, but the reason I guess why I'm interested in the, you know, and it's a fairly kind of, I'm not a historian, it's a fairly kind of potted kind of international lawyer's version of history, drawing on you know, excellent kind of primary archival work of global communications historians at this stage, although I'm quite keen to have a bit of a deeper look in the archives myself. And I think that could be interesting for international legal scholarship more broadly as well. I'm not trying to avoid dealing with these issues, but rather to grasp the opportunity to more deeply examine the political stakes involved and to avoid the temptation to naturalize or dehistoricize our technological and regulatory choices. So as Morozov himself says, once we realize that for the last 100 years or so, virtually every generation has felt like it was on the edge of a technological revolution, be it the telegraph age, the radio age, the plastic age, the nuclear age, or the television age, maybe ours is now the AI age. Maintaining the myth that our own period is unique and exceptional will hopefully become much harder. Turning to technology as infrastructure for global governance in our own time, without a clearer sense of this history and these dynamics, risks, I think, reinforcing rather than transforming international legal histories of inequality and imbalance, all while generating a future-focused fantasy of disruptive progress. So it's experimentation and disruption and so on. And often I think that can be quite distracting from the kinds of regulatory choices that we could make in terms of a sort of different kind of international society. I mean, I'm a bit of an idealist in these terms, but hopefully a critical idealist. So uncritically turning to technology for answers or as a metaphor for an innovative and an infrastructural international law risks, I think, the continuation of patterns of response which fail to effectively regulate private forms of power on the international plane. I think that's my real underlying concern, my real sort of driving concern. Today, as we know, private power over global communications infrastructure has only magnified. But as I've tried to suggest in this presentation and in the work that I'm developing at the moment, I think it was present from the beginning. Thank you.